Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of White Coats Real Talk. I'm Akshara Anand.
And I'm your co-host, Afarva Anand.
White Coats Real Talk is a podcast where we connect with incredible physicians to break down complex medical topics into real-life conversations. Our goal is to make healthcare relatable and engaging for teens and young adults, while also spotlighting the passion and humanity behind the white coat. Today's episode is especially important for anyone who cares about women's health. Gynecologic cancers impact thousands of women every year. But beyond treatment, there's a growing focus on prevention, early detection, and understanding the genetics that put women at risk.
That's why we're thrilled to welcome Dr. Melissa Frey. Dr. Frey is an associate professor of obstetrics and gynecology in the Division of Gynecologic Oncology at Weill Cornell Medicine. She's also the director of the Genetics and Personalized Cancer Prevention Program. She specializes in caring for women with hereditary cancer syndromes like BRCA1, BRCA2, as well as Lynch syndrome. And her research focuses on advancing how we use genetics and personalized strategies to reduce cancer risk. Thank you so much for being here today, Dr. Frey. How are you doing?
I'm great. Thank you so much for having me here.
Yeah, for sure. So, getting started, before we specifically get into your work, we'd love for our listeners to get to know a little better about you. So, could you tell us about your journey into medicine and what first sparked your interest, and how you found your way into OBGYN specifically?
Absolutely. I'm one of those people who has wanted to be a doctor sort of since I could start talking. And so I've always been interested in medicine. I've been interested in the biology of medicine and also was always interested in sort of healthcare, in caring for patients, and loved the idea of sort of a hands-on profession and always thought of myself sort of as a procedure or surgeon or as a surgeon. And so I think I always knew I wanted to combine those passions. And then as I sort of was in high school and in college, started to think about what facet of medicine I was most interested in. And I realized that I was deeply passionate about women's health, and wanted to find a career where I could be an advocate of women, take care of women, but also sort of pursue my interest in the biology of disease. And for me specifically, that was the biology of cancer, and do something sort of felt like I was hands-on, sort of using technical skills. And so for me, that was obstetrics and gynecology, and then ultimately gynecologic oncology, where I could operate on patients, give chemotherapy and other treatments to patients, and take care of patients sort of long term, sort of throughout their life.
That's amazing. We really talked to a lot of doctors, and sometimes, like, most of them have one path before, and they completely switch around and go into another specialty. It seems like you really wanted to go women's health and OBGYN, so that's really amazing. And so you're also specialized in gynecologic oncology and cancer genetics. How do you explain this to patients or even young teens about what you do really in a few sentences?
Absolutely. And so I will say, you just mentioned that you talked to a lot of doctors who kind of change. And I actually did have a change because I trained as a surgeon and I trained as an oncologist. And so, really, what I was spending most of my time doing was operating on cancer and writing prescriptions for chemotherapy and caring for patients undergoing chemotherapy. And sort of a light bulb moment for me was while I was in one of these really long surgeries. Was realizing, unfortunately, for a disease like ovarian cancer, even with the best surgery and the best treatment, many, if not most, patients will ultimately pass away from their disease. And so that got me thinking about prevention and how do we kind of take 10 steps back and prevent the patient from ever needing to be on the operating room table. And for cancer, and specifically for ovarian cancer, the best method of prevention that I identified at the time was sort of understanding genetic risk and sort of finding people who are living at an increased risk for cancer before a cancer diagnosis and using that information to prevent cancer. And so I personally had a shift in my career to sort of really entering this prevention world. And so to summarize kind of what I do and to answer your question, I think cancer genetics is a lot about risk stratifying people and understanding that although cancer is very common, telling someone that they have a 40% lifetime risk of cancer, because that's the general risk probably across the population, is not so helpful. You need to find someone who has a 10% risk and someone who has a 90% risk and tell them their unique cancer risk so that you can take steps to prevent cancer. And so that's really what I focused on is risk stratification and identifying people at risk.
Yeah, for sure. And also, your academic path has been incredibly impressive from Duke to Cornell and NYU. How did these experiences and learning at these different institutions shape how you practice your medicine and how you treat your patients today?
I feel extremely grateful to have had training at multiple places. And I think this is for two reasons. I think it's good to see different approaches to care and the way different hospitals are run and different patient populations. But I also think, and especially for kind of students and young people who are entering the field, one of the most important parts of career development is finding mentors. So finding people that are going to help you, give you advice, sort of care about where the direction of your career. And you'll have different mentors for different things. You'll have research mentors, you will have clinical mentors, you'll have medical school mentors. And so for me, having all these institutions at which I've been able to spend time has allowed me to have sort of build my team of mentors who've continued to help me. And I'm still in touch with my undergraduate mentors from Duke, and then of course have many new mentors along the way. And so I think that's been a great thing. But I also will say I've spent the majority of my career at one institution, which is where I am now, which is Weill Cornell Medicine. And it's also been a true gift to get to really spend the majority of my career in one place because I get just to have such great colleagues and really understand how an institution works. And so I think I've had the best of both worlds as far as multiple institutions, but then an allegiance and sort of a real history at one institution.
Yeah, amazing. And all doctors we know that they always say that mentors are really important and how really stand on our backs and how they really help us become into a better person. And I feel like that they really helped you too. And so moving on to more of the details, cancer is one of the second is the second leading cause of death in the United States. And each year around 84,117,000 women in the US are diagnosed with gynecologic cancers. To help our listeners understand really better, could you explain the few gynecologic cancers you see when you practice or in surgery?
Absolutely. So I'll start by saying the kind of gynecologic cancers in general that we see are ovarian cancer, uterine cancer, cervical cancer, and then less commonly vulvar and vaginal cancer. The most common of those cancers are ovarian and endometrial cancer. And so for those of you who don't know, the uterus is sort of the muscle that holds a pregnancy, and the ovaries are sort of two organ their organs that people have two of them, and they make hormones. They also are where the oocytes come from, which allows for fertility. And these two are the most common cancers, and there are several thousand cases per year. There are probably about 70,000 cases of endometrial cancer a year, and probably about 20,000 cases of ovarian cancer a year. And so the majority of what I do is take care of patients, which again usually involves surgery and for some patients, additional therapy like chemotherapy or radiation therapy, or now sort of precision medicine or kind of immunotherapy or other really targeted treatments.
So, specifically on endometrial cancer, which is the most common gynecologic cancer, as you stated. For our listeners, what are some of the key symptoms that they should watch out for, or when should they see a doctor, and why is the early detection for this specific cancer so important?
Absolutely. So the most common symptom of endometrial cancer is abnormal bleeding, abnormal vaginal bleeding. This is more common in women who've already gone through menopause, and so we call that postmenopausal bleeding. So a woman who is no longer getting a normal period suddenly starts bleeding. However, there are rising rates of endometrial cancer in younger women who have not gone through menopause, and so in a woman like that, we might see abnormal bleeding, like really heavy periods or bleeding in between periods. And the good news is that this disease often presents with this kind of bleeding early. And so if someone kind of shows to their doctor and reports this, we can often diagnose this at an early stage when it is curable, often with surgery. And so I think the biggest recommendation that I give people is any abnormal bleeding really at any age should prompt a workup by someone's gynecologist.
For sure. I think it's important to really see it before it actually gets serious. And another common gynecologic cancer is ovarian cancer.
And I believe it's also called the silent killer because early detection can be so challenging. So, what are the symptoms women should watch out for this cancer? And is there a certain age group that's most at risk for this cancer?
So ovarian cancer is less common than endometrial cancer, but for many people can be more catastrophic or more deadly. And the reason is there is no early sign like the abnormal bleeding that we just talked about for endometrial cancer. Ovarian cancer for many people is totally asymptomatic, meaning that you don't feel anything until it becomes metastatic, meaning the cancer cells have left where they started. So it's the ovary, or probably actually the fallopian tube is where most of these cancers begin, but then they spread throughout the belly or the abdominal cavity. So by the time someone's feeling something, which is often like a bloated abdomen or changes in appetite or changes in their bowel function or urinary function, by the time someone feels that, it's because the disease has sort of spread throughout their abdominal area, and so it is advanced. And so it's just very rare for someone to have symptoms when this is truly at an early stage or a stage one. And so as a result, we don't catch this early. And there's also no great screening. For many cancers, for example, breast cancer, we know that mammograms are an excellent screening tool. Despite thousands or hundreds of thousands, probably actually more, millions of dollars of research and hundreds of thousands of patients participating in clinical trials, we have yet to find a reliable method of ovarian cancer screening. So catching this cancer at an early stage. And so, as a result, we're really just left with prevention. And unfortunately, again, we're not finding people at this early stage based on symptoms.
And how do hormonal factors such as like menopause or hormone replacement therapy influence risk for ovarian and endometrial cancers?
It's a great question and an area of a lot of controversy right now. But I would say for many women who have early menopause and need hormones, hormones can be life-changing and can be good for quality of life and longevity. Using hormones sort of inappropriately, so using just a lot of estrogen without progesterone can actually cause uterine cancers. So for someone who is interested in hormone replacement therapy, it's important to work with a physician. But then also birth control pills are another form of sort of hormonal treatment. And we actually know that birth control pills reduce the risk of cancer, of gynecologic cancers, especially ovarian cancer. And so we have sort of pretty convincing data that suggests that 10 years of a combined estrogen and progesterone birth control pill can decrease the risk of ovarian cancer by 50%. So that's the good news. And then I realized I didn't answer your other question. At what age do we usually see these types of gynecologic cancers? It's often women in their 50s and 60s, although certainly we are seeing younger women with these cancers. And I think endometrial cancer, we're not sure why, but one of the risk factors for endometrial cancer is obesity or carrying extra weight. And that's because the adipose tissue in the body actually makes more estrogen. And so more estrogen is more of a stimulus on the uterus to grow and get sort of prepare for a pregnancy, but an overproduction of estrogen can then cause a precancer or cancer of the uterus. And so we are seeing numbers rise in endometrial cancer and numbers rise in younger women who are sort of before the normal age that we used to, or the average age that we used to see this disease onset.
Yeah, and I feel like there's a lot of stigma around like birth control specifically, but there's a lot of good benefits to it, as you mentioned, in like reducing cancers, which I think is pretty cool. And also, one of the biggest risk factors beyond age is having like family history of hereditary breast or ovarian cancer, which is often like linked to inherited gene mutations like BRCA1, BRCA2, or those seen in Lynch syndrome. Can you explain what these genetic risks mean for women and how they impact cancer risk?
Absolutely. So everyone inherits genes from their mother and father, and there are a group of syndromes called hereditary cancer syndromes, whereby one of the genes that someone inherits from either their mother or their father can significantly increase their risk for cancer. And so we'll take an example like BRCA1 and 2. So if someone inherits this gene from either parent, it only takes one copy to sort of have this syndrome. And this gene can be inherited from a mother or a father, and it can be passed to a son or a daughter. This is sort of not dependent on biologic sex. This affects all people. And inheriting a copy of this gene, it doesn't mean that someone's definitely going to get cancer, but we can actually say that sort of if someone has BRCA1, their risk over their lifetime of developing breast cancer is about 60 to 70%. Their risk of developing ovarian cancer is probably about 40%. Their risk of developing pancreatic cancer is about 5%. And so we can actually link a specific gene to specific cancers. And you mentioned Lynch syndrome also, and that syndrome has been linked to colon cancer and uterine or endometrial cancer, among some other cancers. And so if we know that someone's at risk and we do genetic testing, we can identify this mutation, and then we can offer people a personalized plan to either prevent these cancers or catch them at their sort of earliest stage so they are most easily treatable and curable. But these are extremely common, these types of mutations, and they're probably present in about 1 to 5% of the population, probably has one of these hereditary cancer syndromes. But unfortunately, genetic testing remains critically underutilized, meaning most people don't even know they're at risk, never get genetic testing, so can't take advantage of all of these potentially life-saving medical interventions.
Regarding genetic testing, is it only immediate family? Like, if someone has a mother, sister, or daughter diagnosed with ovarian or endometrial cancer, is it only limited in the immediate family, or can like cousins or other people get it? And what aspects of family history matter most?
Great question because it's a very complex topic. So there are published guidelines that are constantly being updated to know sort of who meets eligibility for genetic testing, who's at risk. And as we learn more and more, we're realizing, more of us are at risk. And those eligibility guidelines are really about what insurance covers, not necessarily who should get testing, because many people think, including myself, anyone who wants genetic testing should get it. And so I would say, closest family members sort of portend the greatest risk because if one of your first degree relatives, so parent, sibling, child, has one of these what are called autosomal dominant mutations, there's a 50-50 chance that you will have it. So if it's a first degree relative, as you move further away, so if it's a second degree relative, like a grandparent, an aunt, it then becomes a 25% risk. But I will say that it really depends on the specific cancer. So we know that if someone has a first or second degree relative with ovarian cancer, insurance will cover their genetic testing. And so what I would recommend is, not getting caught up in the details of is it an aunt, a second cousin, a first cousin, but I think meeting with a physician who feels comfortable with this and doing what's called a pedigree. And a pedigree is where you kind of map out someone's family history and go through at least 3 generations to see what happens, because sometimes looking at that family history will show you a pattern that is more important than just saying, I have one aunt with this. And then based on that, we can kind of make a prediction or kind of tell someone, yes, you're at increased risk. I would also tell you a quote I love to, sorry, a statistic I like to quote is that if you kind of did genetic testing on everyone, about 50% of people who test positive, where we find something, don't have the family history that is the prerequisite for genetic testing, meaning we're not that good at predicting who will have mutations. So we will find many mutations, even in people who don't have the necessary family history, which is why I think anyone who wants assessment or genetic testing should have access.
Yeah, for sure. And so if someone does have these mutations, it's not certain that they will develop their cancer, although there is a high percentage. But for young people especially, genetics can sound extremely intimidating or even scary. So how do you go about talking with these patients about their risks while also empowering them to make informed decisions about their health care?
Absolutely. I think that medicine has traditionally been very reactive. So you go to the doctor when you have a problem, you treat an illness when it comes up. And I would argue genetics is an exciting shift where we're moving from reactive to proactive. And so what you're getting from genetic testing is not sort of telling you when and where you're going to get cancer, but really giving you an overall risk profile so that you can make adjustments in your life to prevent these cancers or catch them again at their earliest stage. And so I would argue, yes, finding out that, if someone finds out that they have a 50% risk of colon cancer, that is very scary. But then I would tell them, you know what, you can take aspirin for a few years and reduce that risk in half just by taking an aspirin every day. And if you get a colonoscopy every year or every few years, We will find the cancer before it's a cancer, when it's a tiny polyp, and so it will be cured before you even leave the doctor's office that day. So I'll tell them, you are not going to get a terrible colon cancer because we're going to do these two small interventions so that you stay healthy. And so I think when you kind of flip this as this is not about telling you horrible news, this is about giving you the tools you need to prevent anything from happening. And I think we're getting very good at this in cancer, but this is going to be all aspects of medicine. This is going to be cardiac disease. This is going to be neurologic disease. We're going to get better and better at risk stratifying people. So the whole idea is to be preventative. And so I hope that can take out some of the terror of genetic testing from people, knowing that it's just more information to live better.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I believe that you lead regarding prevention, the genetics and personalized cancer prevention program at Weill Cornell. Can you please explain what that program really does and why it's so important?
So we saw that there was just not sufficient access to genetic testing. So when individuals wanted genetic testing, there were often long wait times, or it was impossible to get in altogether to see a provider. And so we wanted to create a place where anyone interested in cancer risk assessment and genetic testing could come and see a clinician with expertise. But in addition to that, we didn't want to just do genetic testing, because I think what people are worried about is what you both mentioned, is that then you kind of leave someone with this very scary news. And so we wanted to also create a scaffold on the other end that will sort of take care of individuals when they have this increased risk for the rest of their lives and help them make the care plan that's going to keep them safe. And so what we created is a program that does both. A cancer risk assessment, genetic testing that's easily accessible. But then for those people who do need, breast MRIs or medication to decrease breast cancer risk or surgery, a place that will follow people regularly, order any imaging that they need, make the referrals, have a full-time social worker to deal with some of the psychosocial implications, have support groups where patients can come together and have a community around what can be very stressful. And so that is the goal of our program. And so and hopefully we are successful in that. We just launched in September of 2023, but we're working very hard.
It sounds really, really promising because I feel like there are a lot of issues that come with cancer that aren't what meets the eye, but your program seems to be kind of going on these problems and trying to help them, which is really cool. And kind of moving on to the like research and clinical trials, can you share any promising research into blood tests, imaging, or biomarkers that could make early detection of these cancers more reliable?
Well, I would start by saying just plain germline genetic sequencing is not new, but is, as I mentioned, critically underutilized. So the first step is just to use a test that is FDA approved that for a quarter of the population will be covered by insurance. So 25% of people will meet the insurance, based criteria for testing. And so that would be my first step, do genetic testing. Other tests that I think are very important, there's something called breast cancer risk assessment. And so that is not genetics. That's just validated tools, which you could actually access online. There are free versions. Many doctors have versions in their office where you provide just information on your own personal health, like height, weight, age of your first period, age of your first child. And then you also add some family history, and you can actually calculate your lifetime risk for breast cancer. And so one of the most common tools is called Tyrer-Cuzick. And so if you Google that, you can come up with these risk models. There's actually several guidelines that recommend that every woman has this done in her 20s to know what is my lifetime risk for breast cancer. Am I someone who should be doing what's the general guideline of a mammogram starting at 40, or should I start earlier, or should I be doing more screening than a mammogram? And so I would argue that, that's another tool that is evidence-based, actually free. And the majority of women never have it. So I would tell every woman, do that. If you're asking kind of where are we going in the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years and sort of what's on the horizon, I think there are many exciting things. One of the most exciting is called liquid biopsy. And this is the idea that you could take a blood test and from a single blood test for circulating DNA from a tumor throughout the body, and so get a signal for more than 50 types of cancers. So maybe you could do a blood test and say, oh, this person has a very early pancreatic cancer, or this person has a very early liver cancer. And maybe it's so early that it's not even visible on imaging. And so I think there are many companies and researchers that are trying to create these liquid biopsies. And so that is probably what I'm most excited about. But I would also say to date, this is not really standard yet, and it doesn't have, we need more research to know how beneficial they're going to be and what the right patient population is.
Yeah, for sure. And beyond patient care, you're also deeply involved in research, and you've published over 100 peer-reviewed papers and led NIH-funded research. So what research question drives you the most right now?
So I love research, and I've always loved research because I think the idea is that you can take what you learn at the bedside with your patient, think about it, design studies, and create change that can help patients across the country. And that is what's so exciting to me, that you really expand your footprint beyond just your own office or your own institution. So I think what we've talked about a little bit today is my concern that we have tools that could be life-saving that we're not using. And so I'm very interested in accessibility of care and sort of reaching people in general and then reaching the hard-to-reach populations. And so a lot of what I've spent my time working on is sort of creating and delivering digital tools to do some of the things we talked about, to identify people who are at risk for cancer, to identify people who would be who would benefit from genetic testing, and then getting these tools to patients. So one of the things we do kind of at our hospital is kind of create a digital app that can be texted to someone before they even see their physician. We're filling out many forms online now. So this is an extra probably 2 to 3 minutes where you type in some information and then your doctor would get sort of all that information, but also sort of the algorithmic answer to, yes, this person needs genetic testing, or your patient that you're about to see has a 50% risk of breast cancer over her life. Please talk to her about breast screening. And so I'm trying to kind of create those algorithms and then also get those algorithms into routine care for people across our institution and then eventually across the country.
That's amazing. I see that technology is really getting more involved in healthcare and it's really helping expand access to genetic counseling and testing. So cancer is really an emotional diagnosis. So really, how do you really approach these first conversations with patients and help them not worry and fret so much about what's going to happen to them?
I think that I agree with you. It's a really difficult conversation. And I think that a lot of the training to become an oncologist and a lot of what you work on throughout your career is to how to make these conversations go as well as possible and how to be as supportive of the patient as possible. I will say that, one of the things we've been lucky enough to do at our genetics program is to have a full-time social worker who really specializes in psychosocial health available so that I can see a patient, I can talk to them about the medical issues, I can be supportive. But then also, sometimes someone wants to talk to someone in the medical field, but who's not their oncologist about how this feels or kind of, how am I going to tell my relatives and friends and how am I going to tell my workplace? And so all of our patients have the opportunity to meet with this social worker. And I think we're extremely lucky to have this model. And so I would argue is it's being multidisciplinary and having many people in your program that can support your patient and sort of thinking about what your patient needs and trying to meet those needs in real time to make this as easy as possible.
That seems like a really cool addition to this department, and it's really probably helping a lot and inspiring, or just helping the patients that feel so terrible after such a scary diagnosis. And can you share a moment or patient story that has really stayed with you throughout the years or in your career?
Absolutely. So, one of my other areas of research, in addition to some of these digital tools, is what's called cascade testing or family testing. And this is the sort of notion that once you find a mutation, let's say BRCA, in a patient in front of you, not only do you want to help the patient through this, but you also know that, again, her relatives are also at risk. And in reality, it's a big burden to place on someone to say, I know you have a new breast cancer. I know you're planning your surgery. You also have a BRCA mutation. So please call all your relatives, explain this to them, tell them they're at risk, and help them get testing. And I think that is a tremendous burden. And as a result, the majority of relatives in this country are really a third at most. The majority don't get testing. Two-thirds are at least are not getting testing. And so I thought, how can we change this paradigm? And what if we can work with our patients to kind of reach out to their relatives or give them tools to reach out to their relatives to make this process easier? And so we've studied this in several clinical trials and found that if we work and partner with our patients, we can significantly increase rates of family testing. And so the patient I'll talk about is a woman who was a single mom with two kids, very busy, and was diagnosed with breast cancer, and then found out that she had a BRCA mutation. And sadly, her mother had had ovarian and breast cancer. And so really, this woman should have been offered genetic testing years prior, which could have prevented or at least allowed her to catch her breast cancer at an earlier stage. But no one had mentioned that to her. And, I thought that she was going to be just, down and worried and, stressed about dealing with her cancer and dealing, taking care of her kids. But she really, her first thought was, tell me how I can help my sisters. And so she was one of the first people to enroll in one of my family testing clinical trials. And we were able to reach out to several of her siblings across multiple countries who all were able to get genetic testing. And they were all able to use that information to be healthier themselves. And actually, this patient now is completely recovered and went back to get a PhD. And is going to kind of join us as a colleague in the medical field and is now absolutely passionate about patient advocacy, patient communication. And so I think she really embodies the transformation sort of disease and all the horribleness of that to something that can come out, which is really, quite amazing, which was saving her family and now thinking about how this can expand beyond her own family.
I think that's one of the coolest stories I've personally heard on this podcast, with a patient actually coming back into the field and trying to help more people. And it's also really inspiring that her first thought was, how can I help my sisters? And you've also received several teaching awards. So what do you enjoy the most about mentoring students?
I have always loved mentoring students, and I think number one, I was the beneficiary of mentoring when I was a high school student. I was able to, follow a surgeon into the OR, and I think that experience, I knew that moment that this is what I was had to do. Like being in the OR, I was going to do everything I could so that I could then enter that OR professionally in the future. And so I'm so grateful to have had that exposure that I felt like I sort of wanted to give back. But I would also say it's a joy to mentor students. It kind of reminds me of the excitement I felt, and it reminds me how lucky I am to have this career. And so I think I give a lot, but I also get a lot from students. And so, as anyone who works with me knows, I often have, five, even 10 students trailing me around with patients or to surgeries. And I just think it's a great thing about medicine that you can kind of incorporate teaching and mentorship into all parts of your career and practice. And I've gotten tremendous joy from the people I've gotten to mentor.
Yeah, I think mentorship is really important, and we're really grateful that you're here today, inspiring a lot of listeners. And so we always ask doctors what advice they have for the next generation, and including us. So what's some advice you have that you want to pass on to students or just starting to dream about medical career?
Well, number one, I would say it's a fantastic career, and so if you love it, go for it and do whatever it takes. It's a lot of work to get there, and as pre-med and MCATs and all that, it's a lot of work, but it is absolutely worth it. And I think talking about mentorship today, I would say like it's great to find a good mentor, but you could also be a good mentee, and the better mentee you are, the better mentors you will have. And so as you start to meet people through your career, make a list of them. So remember who has helped you. Come to meetings. If you're going to meet with your mentor, come prepared. Come with questions, come with ideas, come with updates, and then keep in touch with your mentors. If someone wrote you a letter of recommendation that helped you get into college or med school, remind them your first year. Say, thank you. My first semester went great. I'm so appreciative. Because I think that, again, you could have the best mentor, but if you're not giving back and you're not coming prepared, you're not giving them a lot to work with. And so I would say, again, do what it takes to go into this field, and then be very thoughtful about collecting your group of mentors and being a good mentee.
And now for like a fun question. What are your favorite books, medical or non-medical?
Sure. So to start, I was a Spanish major when I was an undergraduate at Duke, and this is partially because I always wanted to go to med school, but I also loved literature and language, and I wanted to study abroad. And so I thought, also, speaking Spanish would help me with my patients. And so I was very lucky to do that, but also got me very into sort of literature. And one of my favorite authors is Isabel Allende. She has a book called The House of Spirits, which I love, and I love the magic realism. I love the political history and family saga, and so I would strongly recommend that. And then, as far as medical books, there's a wonderful author named Abraham Verghese who's written several books now that have medical themes. But he has a memoir called My Own Country, which is sort of a blend of medicine, humanity, culture, and it's really the chronicle of his experience as a young infectious disease doctor during the early AIDS epidemic in rural Tennessee. And so, for anyone who's interested in that history and a really great medical memoir, I'd recommend My Own Country or really anything by Abraham Verghese is great.
Amazing. I'll be sure to check those out. And so lastly, for the last question of today, what is one message you would most want women to take away about gynecologic cancers, whether it's about risk, early detection, or taking charge of their health?
I would say be proactive about your health. So, think about your family history, report that to your physician if you have a concerning family history. Say that you're interested in knowing more. If you have any symptoms, bleeding, cramping, pain, don't be embarrassed. It is most important that you bring these symptoms to your doctor so that you can get an early evaluation. And if there is an issue, have it be identified, treated, and cured as soon as possible.
Dr. Frey, thank you so much for being here today and joining us and sharing such valuable insights about gynecologic cancers, genetic risk, and the importance of early detection. Your expertise and compassion really shine through, and I know our listeners will take a lot from this conversation.
Yeah, thank you so much, and really appreciate you being here, and thank you all for listening.